Welcome back to our class of the Book of Daniel, and this is going to be Class 7, Part 3. And we, in our last couple episodes, we have been discussing still the 11th chapter, and we're in the 11th chapter, and we're going to be looking at page 292, page 294 in your textbook. And again, this is chapter 11. We have seen the seesaw of that of the north and south. Two kingdoms, that being Syria and Egypt, going back and forth. And we have went through several different periods of leadership from about 323 on the Egypt side of Ptolemy the first, Ptolemy the second, which also was called Philadelphus, and Ptolemy the third, and Ptolemy the fourth, and we're getting into the northern kings, would have been Seleucus one, Antiochus one, and Antiochus the second, and the second went by Theos, or Antiochus. Using the name Theos, which means God. And then, of course, Seleucus the second, and Seleucus the third, and Antiochus the third. And then we return to Seleucus the fourth. And before we get through with our study today, I'm sure we'll be talking about Antiochus the fourth, Epiphanes. And these kings overlap each other in the time frame. But there again, as we go back to page 294, and you can see that list of kings on page 284 in a chart. But on page 294, we have begun to continue to see the progression of the old Roman Empire taking growth in the Middle East and in the world at that time. But there again, we've got this struggle between the two kingdoms of that of the north, the Syrian, and also that of Egypt. Now, verse number 18 of the 11th chapter says, "After this, he shall turn his face to the coastlands and shall take away or take many. But a ruler shall bring the reproach against them to an end, and with the reproach removed, he shall turn back on him." Now, we continually see a good portion or most of this chapter where we're seeing where the angel, and most likely this is Gabriel, that's sharing with Daniel. He's giving the prophecy or what's being prophesied. So we're going to see over and over the next thing the angel prophesied. And what we see is how that Antiochus would abandon his plans to take Egypt and go after the coastlands. So he had been coming through the Holy Land. He'd been coming through Israel or Jerusalem. And now he's going to attempt to take the coastlands. With that being said, we understand that Antiochus the Great is who we're talking about. He was upset. He was furious over that of the protection that Egypt was getting from Rome. And second of all, he was still upset and furious because his daughter Cleopatra had married and then betrayed him. And he was wanting to use that as a way to overtake and use against Egypt with this marriage. What we find is that with this desire to take the coastal lands, which we're talking about, that of the coast of the Mediterranean area, he assembled a naval force. He had about 300 naval ships. And with that, He started taking control of cities and islands along the coast of the Mediterranean Sea. Now, again, what we must remember is that this basically was controlled by the Romans. And we can know for surety that the Romans not only had been protective or with that of helping Egypt, but they weren't just going to sit by idly and allow allow the Syrians to take the Mediterranean areas. Now, we understand that from history that there was a naval commander that the Romans had commissioned. He was a young naval commander, and his name was Scipio. And he actually took a fleet of Roman warships, and his mission was to go after the Syrian vessels. And what we find is that that's exactly what takes place. And Scipio, he actually found and sank most of the Syrian navy. And so, of course, this was not very a very pleasant result for Antiochus the Great. But with that being said, we can fully understand how that this was continuing the movement, the growth, the advancement of that of the Roman Empire. And then, of course, we can see how that it's coming into play where eventually the Romans would be in control of Israel when the Anointed One or Jesus came. And of course, we know that the Romans were in control of Jerusalem in the time of Jesus's coming and birth and his life. We would rehearse that this Roman Empire eventually by 70 AD destroys Jerusalem and the temple. Now, there are just some things to elaborate. And also, the old Roman Empire will be the revised, there'll be the revised Roman Empire that will be back for the second coming of Jesus. So, what this is foretelling us is that this is some of the activities that will take place during the tribulation with nations against nations, and even Jesus prophesied that there would be wars and rumors of wars. There'll be nations against nations, and we'll see some of this conflict going on in the Middle East, the Mediterranean area, and even today. I may have mentioned this. There is military naval force not only on the Mediterranean, but also in the Red Sea area. So keep that in mind. So this is putting things into perspective for the end of the ages. Now, with this coming about that the Alexander, excuse me, not Alexander, but Antiochus the Great had suffered this loss, verse 19 tells us, then he shall return his face toward the fortress of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. Now, again, we have one of the phrases, the angel continued revealing the vision to Daniel. And what we find here is what being predicted is that Antiochus would return to his own country following his defeat along the coastlines. So what we see is that Antiochus the Great, he returns home, and of course, this has been a defeat. He was actually watching his own back because he was concerned about the Romans being after him. And what we do find is that once Antiochus the Great returned back to Syria, he began to make a plan for peace. We know that Rome by no means was in a mood to be generous in any way, I'm sure. But that's what Antiochus the Great was wanting to do was to seek peace after this defeat and getting back home. Of course, there would be a great price. There would be an expense. There would be an advantage that the Romans would have. And there was a great loss that Antiochus the Great had to take in consideration to attempt to buy peace. Of course, we can see from that line of the Syrians this progression of how the Antichrist works, buying peace, like buying land for peace. And he did have to give up chunks of some area that Syria would have had control of in Europe and also Asia. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, in his military strength, he had to give up most of whatever he had as far as any naval fleet. And so the worst thing about this was for 12 years, there was a taxation that would take place. And this was so strenuous on Antiochus the Great and the Syrian people that it began to be a struggle for them to meet this tax. And of course, even in King Antiochus the Great attempting to meet this debt, he was killed and put to death. So with that, we understand that he would have had a successor. And even the Book of Daniel in the 20th verse gives us an indication that the angel prophesies who will be his successor. Look at verse number 20. It says, "There shall rise in this place," or in his place, talking about Antiochus the Great, "one who imposes taxes on the glorious kingdom, but within a few days he shall be destroyed, but not in anger or in battle." Now, what we find is more struggle, more difficulties within the family of the rulers. He was definitely succeeded by his oldest son, which would have been Seleucus Philopator. Seleucus inherited the large debt his father agreed to pay in order to obtain peace with Rome. So just because Antiochus the Great was killed and now not in the picture, it did not cease the taxation, the burden. What happens here is we don't just see the change of leadership. We see that the kingdom is still in debt with this taxation. We see that son, Seleucus, Philopater, attempted to even raise taxes upon the Syrians and to collect them. And they were near the 12-year ending, but it really caused a lot of financial crisis. It brought such a crisis that even Seleucus Philopater decided that he would send his treasure, he would send those from Syria to go to Jerusalem. And again, we can see where there's devastation to the temple. They confiscate gold and silver vessels that were being used at the temple. And then, of course, there's possibilities of whoever might have actually poisoned him. But he was poisoned and died. So we see the progression of what takes place in Syria. We understand that there is a parallel here that's mentioned at the bottom of your page on page 295. We don't see Anticus, we don't see, excuse me, Anticus, the great's son, Seleucus, Philopater, dying in battle. And all of these different ones, we see the characteristics and some of the foreshadow of that, of what's to come with the Antichrist. The Antichrist will not die in battle. He will be captured by Jesus at the second coming and thrown into a lake of fire burning with brimstone. Let's move on. We look at Daniel chapter 11, verse 21. And in his place shall arise a vile person to whom they will not give the honor of royalty, but he shall come in peacefully and seize the kingdom by entry. Now, we're setting the timing now of these kings that are mentioned for the north, and each one of them give a parallel of something of characteristics of that of the Antichrist in some aspect. We're coming now to the time of Anticus, Epiphanes, which would have actually been the fourth in our list of those of the kings on page 284. Now, this particular individual is definitely a vile person, very vile. Said the next Daniel was told that the next king to rule would be a vile person. Actually, he was not even heir to the throne. And think about that for a moment. The Antichrist is not going to necessarily be somebody that's an heir or a principal person that is supposed to be at the forefront to step in. With that being said, we understand that Antichus Epiphanes the fourth was not the true heir to the throne. And as I stated, even as the Antichrist necessarily is not being recognized as a leader that is to be in power, but it develops and happens. After Seleucus Philopater tried to confiscate the temple vessels, he was poisoned. So remember that. And he had two sons, and of course, the oldest, as normal, would have been the one to have been the one to inherit the throne, or to be crowned king, and his name would have been Demetrius. But Seleucus Philopator had a younger brother, and Anticus, who was an extraordinary good manipulator. Now, this is how we get into that of Anticus Epiphanes, or Anticus the fourth. So he had a younger brother, Anticus, instead of his son, that would have been Demetrius. He had a lot of characteristics, Anticus, of his daddy. He was a very cunning person. He could have been similar to that of Cleopatra, that had married off to Ptolemy. And so we began to understand how that the characteristics of the Antichrist are going to be portrayed through this individual. And we understand in verses 21 and through verse 23 of the 11th chapter, there's at least three key words that we need to look at and consider. And they are that of prefigure, or he is prefigure of the Antichrist. They're being peaceable and intrigue and deceitfully. And let's look at those verses for just a moment. In verse number 21, of the 11th chapter, and his estate shall stand up, and in his estate shall stand up a vile person to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peacefully and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. So, with that word intrigue, it means that people were captive, or it caught their attention, or they were fascinated, they were curious. They wanted to know more about. So verse number 21 tells us that he's going to come in peacefully. He's going to obtain the kingdom by flattery. Let's look at verse number 23. And after the league made with him, he shall work deceitfully. Deceitfully. For he shall come up and shall become strong with a small people. A small people. So we can see where he's going to look peaceful. Even Antiochus Epiphanes, or Antiochus the Fourth, and we see that he is a forerunner or example of the Antichrist to come. Now, he actually picked up, and he did just as his other his father Antiochus the Great left off. He had the unction and desire to indeed attack Egypt, the king of the south, and so we began to see how that he moved small numbers of troops to the Egyptian border, but or that's what they looked at and thought he had, but actually he had moved a large army. He had moved it he had moved, and probably this was a strategic way that he moved it, as he did through Israel, and looked like it was smaller than it was. There's a note down here in the bottom of the page that's by John F. Woodford. Let me read it. It says, beginning with verse 21 through 35, a major section of this chapter is devoted to the comparatively obscure Syrian ruler who was on the throne from 175 to 164 B.C. So this would be the time frame of Antiochus the Fourth, previously alluded to as the little horn. And we could go back, and I won't take the time to do it, but you can go back and look at the scriptures there in Daniel chapter 8, verses 9 through 14, and verses 23 through 25. And of course, if you remember correctly, the little horn was the one that rises when the ten horns, and we're talking in reference to that of chapter 8. And we see where the ten horned would come up, and then we see where this little horn represents that of the Antichrist. It goes on, it says, he reigned in the days of the decline of the Syrian power and the rise of the Roman to the west, and only his death in 164 B.C. prevented his humiliation by Rome. So actually death took him before he was totally humiliated and defeated by Rome. From the standpoint of Scripture and the revelation by the angel to Daniel, this was the most important feature of the entire Third Empire. The next thing was the thought of deceit that's mentioned also in the Scriptures here, verse 23, or that he will work deceitfully. And the Antichrist will rise, and when he does in power, there will be people that deceit really cannot operate unless it's out of people's lack of knowledge or understanding or not knowing, and we could even say the word ignorance. And of course, we know that religious people, true leaders and religious people left on the earth will be lost. There won't be spirit-filled and godly men and women in the pulpits. Now, I'm not here to say that there won't be some that will give their life and they'll see the truth and they will attempt to teach and reach people possibly. But there again, as far as what would be in any order of any acceptance, we would understand would be those that are not going to propagate the truth. So the Antichrist, he's going to rise to a world to power. And we think that there's biblical ignorance today. There's going to be a biblical ignorance. And they're going to be looking. They're going to be looking for answers, the world is. They're going to be looking for somebody that can come in whatever turmoil there is, even from the fact of this multitude of people that have been raptured away and whatever state the governments are in and all these things. And so how he rises is going to be deceitful. He's going to come in with peace. He's going to come in with prosperity. He's going to meet little resistance. And they're not going to really know who he really is. And let me just say this. You can look this in history in a little more depth. Actually, at the turmoil of Germany being in debt for the First World War and having to pay pay debt for the First World War. And sadly enough, Adolf Hitler sat down even in prison or jail before he ever became to power and wrote a book called Mein Kampf. And in it, he actually spelled out what he was going to do or what his goals was. And so with that being said, with the financial issues of the German people at that time, of course, we know that he blamed the Jews for a lot of things that was not true. But there again, what I want you to understand is that he came in making promises to the German people, what he was going to be able to do for them, and they bought it. They believed him. And, of course, we know the devastation that it was on the world, and I'm not here in no way trying to build a case that he was the Antichrist. He wasn't. He was a Antichrist. So with that being considered now, we understand the tactic. We understand the Antichrist and this example that we're seeing through Antiochus the fourth. And so with this, we'll move on to verse number 22. We'll move to verse 22 of the 11th chapter. With the force of a flood, they shall be swept away from before him and be broken, and also the prince of the covenant. Now, previously, I didn't really make comment when things are taking place, even in a closer proximity thereafter, the rapture and the tribulation, we find that there's going to be the division of the 10 kingdoms. We realize that Satan will assist him to seize the world government through his flattery and things of that nature. Now, looking at verse 22, we see that the angel is given a prophetic statement that the contemptible king would destroy a great army. We also see that it's predicted a prince of the covenant would be destroyed. So let's look at some things that's going to be considered here. Antiochus the fourth attacked Egypt, and we see that the Egyptians, they struck back. There was a lot of casualties. Antiochus Epiphanes won the battle, and he actually even captured the Egyptian king Ptolemy Philometor. And this would have been, if you remember, Cleopatra. That would have been the plot of Antiochus the Great, his daughter, to marry the Syrian, excuse me, to marry the Egyptian king to have a means of manipulating. Now, we begin to see that even Antiochus the Fourth, he breaks agreements, he betrays. And we understand that there may be some question who this prince of the covenant was, but many believe that it by this time, understanding the influence that Antiochus would have had in that of Jerusalem and with the Jews, many believe that it would have been the Jewish high priest that would have been Onias the Third. And we understand that he actually had him murdered and gotten rid of, and he would have appointed his brother. And his brother's name was Jason, and he would have become the high priest of Israel. Now, first of all, we see that this is inappropriate. It's not a foreign Gentile leader's place to appoint the high priest over the temple. So there again, we see with this approval that Antiochus the Fourth would have made of Jason, we see that this was a way to manipulate, and Jason actually was one that caused a lot of Jews to deny their faith. And we see that the Antichrist is an example of the one that will manipulate and use even the false prophet. That's why it's considerable who, with the parallel here, who this priest was, or who the covenant was broke with. So we see that the Antichrist not only will be a powerful military leader, but he will have the one that he will approve that will be the religious leader or the spokesperson. And I have the tendency to believe that it's very well possible the deception will be of who the Antichrist is, whether he's Jewish blood or not, or descendant. And also, I believe there's got to be some deception there for the false prophet to have any kind of capability to lead the Jewish people in any way that would be temple order. So we can see where, even though really Antiochus the Fourth really did not have the authority to appoint who would be the high priest, but we see that it's a brother. So there again, I can see where the Antichrist and the false prophet, the deception that will take place in the end time or the tribulation period, and to bring deceit and deception, cleverness, however you want to say it, with the Jewish people. Now, Renan E. Showers says this, and I quote, "Onias was called the Prince of the Covenant because it was the high priest's responsibility to see that Israel kept its covenant with God." So Mr. Showers is telling us that he gives the commentary that he believes that he would have been the one that's being spoken of here, the Prince of the Covenant. Now, deceit does not It's not just something that happens, it continues. Deceit and more deceit is a subtitle. Let's look at verse 23 again. And after the league is made with him, he shall act deceitfully. So we understand that the league has been made, and then there's going to be an act of deceitfully where they're deceiving. For he shall come up and become strong with a small number of people. Now, we continue to see the interaction here of what's taking place with deceit. I want to just reemphasize that deceit will be a way of life during the tribulation. We realize by that time that the spirit of the Antichrist will be that of actually, I honestly believe that Satan will embody the Antichrist. There'll be false Christ and false prophets that's going to rise, and even Jesus said that, and possibly even deceive the very elect. The Antichrist is even just as Antichrist the Fourth will have looks as a small number of people. He's going to start the Antichrist as a little horn there in Daniel 7:25. He will rise from obscurity to a position of world domination. And with the help, and it'll be with a small help or the help of a small number of world leaders. It's tendency to understand that these 10 leagues of nations, or however that's going to be, are going to be a part of this, of bringing him to the forefront. Antichrist the Fourth was actually a living example of Christ, the wicked man who will gain control of the whole world during the tribulation period. We just continue to see the similarities of how there'll be peace talked and war planned. The Antichrist, he uses rhetoric and terms that will sound sweet, but yet it'll be that is bringing horrific and bringing terror. And definitely there'll be very much dishonesty. Now, on page 299, there is a chart there that gives you scripture, and it gives you the characteristic. Now, it uses the word the integrity of the Antichrist. I don't think there's any integrity. But with that being said, we can see that it's speaking of his character that's not very of integrity. But let's see what it says here. It says, he shall cause deceit to prosper. And secondly, he will break his covenant. He is a liar. And then in Zechariah chapter 11, verse 16 and 17, whatever era of that even Antichrist the Fourth would have been projecting or being perceived as being one that would have cared about people, will definitely be found that he's like a worthless shepherd, a worthless shepherd. Another thing that I thought that's kind of interesting is even how that our writer of our text uses the, instead of a Robin Hood, a wicked Robin Hood. In verse number 24, it says, he shall enter peacefully even into the richest places of the providence, and he shall do what his fathers have not done, nor his forefathers. He shall disperse among them the plunder, the spoil, and riches, and he shall devise his plans against the stronghold, but only for a time. Now, I'll probably repeat this in some aspect, but I want you to see that latter part, but only for a time. God is the one that is still in control. There may be a season, but there is a time. And so what may look like a bad situation, and that is, there is a time. Now, with this being said, what we're going to find is to consider here with this passage of scripture that the angel is telling us, states that Antiochus the IV, he would actually, and he did, and we're going to see this with the Antichrist. He's going to invade. He's going to go to places and countries and territories and areas, and he's going to go where there's wealth. He's going to go where there's riches. He's going to go, and he's going to take of these resources. The textbook says he would take plunder, spoil, and riches, but not to keep it. But what it is, it's a payoff. It's a way to pay for followers. And that's the reason he's called a wicked Robin Hood. He's going to steal, but he's going to give, and he's going to buy people. He's going to take advantage of them. And, you know, sadly, we can see that in politics. We can see that in our own government today where people's, I hate to say it, but their votes are being bought. Privileges, if you want to call it a privilege, not, well, maybe privilege is not the right word, but things that are being given to people, that's just drawing attention to, well, the government will take care of me, and they're kind of bought off or paid with benefits, then they're scrapped from it eventually and taken advantage of. Actually, Antiochus will make a covenant with Ptolemy Philometor, and this will put many of the Egyptians at ease. So it's going to be similar to that of what happens with the Jews. So we're seeing these things with these particular things that are being said. They're not going to realize that Antiochus is a liar and he's thieving. He's taking advantage of the rich or the providences, even of Egypt, and then he's taking and giving to those of the heads of gangs. He's distributing the loot among his own followers, and he's trying to continue to build loyalty to him. Or to himself. And we could definitely say that there's scripture that we can look at that is even in the book of Daniel, this very chapter. I want you to look at verse number 42 and 43 and verse 44. Let's just read those because actually we're going to see what Antiochus done. Actually, there's going to be during the period of the Antichrist where some of this is going to be, this is being foretold what will take place even then. Verse 42, he shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape, but he shall have power over the treasuries of gold and silver and all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Ethiopian shall be at his steps. But tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him before he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to make away many. Now there's two things that are said. There's going to be tidings out of the east and out of the north, and they're going to trouble the Antichrist. There's several things that are mentioned here that are the days of Antiochus and their Antichrist that are numbered, or it gives an indication that what's going to take place. And I'm going to read a little bit here. It says, the angel said, Antiochus Epiphanes shall devise his plan against the strongholds, but only for a time. Remember I said something about that. God controls all things, and he has drawn a line that Antiochus could not cross. Consider the fact that God said the Jews would serve the king of Babylon for 70 years. Bingo, been fulfilled. Okay. The two witnesses will prophesy 1260 days. That's yet to come during the tribulation. Then Jesus said Jerusalem will be trampled by Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. Luke 21, verse 24. Then we see that even with what's being said in the book of Daniel, Gabriel told Daniel the Messiah would appear 7 weeks and 2 weeks and 62 weeks. Would appear 7 weeks and 62 weeks, which is 173,880 days after the command to restore and build Jerusalem. So we know that there's going to be 49 years, is what's being said here, and that will be in reference to around, well, then we got this, I'm sorry, we got the 49 years, it's the 7 weeks, and then the 62 weeks, and that's going to take us up to the time of the ending of the Babylonian, going into the period of time of the restoration of the temple, after they go back and build the walls and these kind of things that takes place. And then the completion of the other 62 weeks will be at the coronation of Jesus, or when he comes into Jerusalem, mounted on a donkey, prior days of just a few days prior of him being crucified. We're going to have our 69 weeks at that time. And right now we're in the period of time where the clock is stopped. And after a command to restore and build Jerusalem, the angel was saying Antiochus will be limited and his days will be numbered concerning the Antichrist. Now here's where we're getting into that last week. Concerning the Antichrist, it means the tribulation period will last 7 weeks or 2520 days, and not one more. We will soon see that the Antichrist will prosper until the wrath has been accomplished, which is in verse number 36. Let's look at verse 36. And the king shall do according to his will, and he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods. Now that's Jehovah. And shall prosper until the indignation be accomplished, for that is determined shall be done. So there's an amen at the end of that. What's going to be done shall be done. excuse me. We already see that in chapter 7, verse 25, that the saints will be given into the hand for a time and a times and a half a time. So we see the tribulation period, and then, of course, we know that latter part will be the most severe after the covenant has been broken. We also understand or need to understand that during the tribulation, there'll be nations that will be conquered. There will be their goods taken by the Antichrist. That will be the reward to those that are wicked people who support him. Now, there's another king that arises after Ptolemy Philometor. And he would have been the brother of this king. And it's his brother that becomes, and his name would have been Physcon, or Ptolemy Philcon. And so let's look at verse number 25 of the 11th chapter. He shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall stir up to battle with a very great and mighty army, and he shall not stand, for they shall devise plans against him. Now, Antiochus, he's going to attack, Antiochus the fourth is going to attack Egypt. And we understand there's going to be this new king, which is the brother, and his name is going to be Ptolemy Physcon. And he's going to pull, he pulled together a large army, and he fought back. But what sadly happens is that Physcon, he has men that commit treason, and they desert him, and they join Antiochus the Fourth. And so what this results in is another defeat for Egypt. Again, as we were saying, he will not be able to, or Egypt will not be able to stand. And Daniel even received this approximately 200 years before it happened. These things where the Antichrist will come, or the example of the Antichrist will come against other nations. Now, in verse number 26, let's see, it says, yes, those who eat of the portion of his delicacies shall destroy him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. Here's another thing that the angelic or the angel predicts and identifies. Some of those who would be involved in the treason as those who eat from the king's provisions. And what we find is that, in other words, the king of the south would be betrayed and members of his own court. That would betray, that betrayal would lead to a military defeat and many casualties. Now, our writer gives us kind of a analogy of how this is in similarity of even at the Feast of Passover, Jesus celebrating how that there was that of the spirit of Antichrist with that of Judas, how he would have ate a piece of bread, he would have turned his back on the Lord, and he would have went out and betrayed the Lord. So there's an example of what will take place with that similarity. Interesting enough, we look at verse number 27, and as these things continue to play out with the negotiation, peacemaking, that of deceptiveness, look at verse 27. Both these kings, we're talking about the king of the south, and we're talking about the king of the north, Antiochus the fourth, and also Ptolemy Physcon. Both these kings' hearts shall be bent on evil, and they shall speak lies at the same table. But it shall not prosper, for the end will still be at an appointed time. So God's got an appointed time. He's still in control, no matter what's taking place. We understand that Daniel is told that the king of the north and the king of the south, they are going to sit down together. And we're going to find there's going to be negotiation with the Antichrist during the period with Epiphanes or Antiochus the Fourth and Ptolemy sitting down together to discuss the situation, to settle their differences. We see the similarity of what will take place in the book of Revelation where the Antichrist arriving, even seen on a white horse. Some people in the book of Revelation picture this as Christ. This is not Christ at this point. He will use peace to destroy many and the covenant to dupe or to destroy or to deceive Israel. His actions will make Antiochus Epiphanes look like an amateur. Ptolemy will be exceeded only by the gullibility of our future government leaders. So we're going to see this take place during the during the time of the Antichrist. This is an example of it in the time of the North and the South kings. even in the terms of Antiochus leaving Egypt, he left with prosperity. He returned to his own land. But even during that, he would have come through Israel on his way returning home. And doing so, he would have used this as a time to oppose the covenant of God with Israel. Things had begun to change in Israel since Antiochus the IV had passed through on his way to Egypt. Now, here's what's interesting as we parallel the book of Revelation with what will take place with the Antichrist. There had been those that had heard or rumored or believed that Antiochus the IV was dead. And of course, this was not an unhappy moment, but it was that the Jews were happy about. What we find is that there had been some revolting amongst the Jews, and they had driven a stronghold of that of the Syrians out. Now, with the fact that they learned that Antiochus the IV is near Jerusalem, he decides to pay a visit. And he comes and he attacks, he plunders. Of course, he kills 40,000 Jews. He made slaves. Again, the temple was looted. And there was women raped and things of this nature that takes place. We're going to see the Antichrist work and operate in the same way in the time frame that will be in that last 3 years of the tribulation. It's been given to consider the thought of Antiochus the IV with this belief that he was dead, to make the parallel with that of how that the Antichrist will have a fatal wound to his head. Some believe that this will be a wound that could be by a sword, but it'll be healed and the world will be amazed. And of course, this is going to bring not only like it did for Antiochus, those that will follow him, but that will happen with the Antichrist also. Now, also, we need to remember what we talked about earlier too, that in Zechariah chapter 11 and verse 17, we understand that he's been struck by the sword, causing his right arm to wither and his right eye to be blinded. He becomes the worthless shepherd with what Zechariah gives us. In Daniel 11:29, it says, "At the appointed time he shall return and go toward the south, but it shall not be like the former or the latter." Now, we're being told that Antiochus the IV, he is going to invade Egypt another time. What we need to understand that's taking place is that we have the point that Antiochus the IV is determined he's going to conquer Egypt. So he tries again. And this is families fighting against each other from the north to the south when we think about it, because actually Ptolemy Philometor and Ptolemy Sicon, they actually are nephews of Antiochus. What happens is that Ptolemy Philometor and Ptolemy Fescon, they have actually settled their differences. And of course, Antiochus has appealed to Rome for help. I think I let me correct something. I believe I said Anticus Epiphanes, and I meant that the two that were ruling together in the south, they appealed to Rome for help, is what I meant to say in reference to verse 11 of 29. Now in 11:30 of Daniel, for ships from Cyprus shall come against him, therefore he shall be grieved and return in rage against the Holy Covenant and do damage. So he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. Now we see that the angel is giving further information here. He's predicting that Anticus Epiphanes would be opposed by ships of the western coastlands. He would turn around and vent his rage on the covenant of God one more time. He had changed his mind. This would cause him to change his mind about invading Egypt again, but the anger and the rage allows him to want to vent it against the covenant of God. He would, but he would deal kindly with those who abandoned the covenant. So it's going to look as if he's going to give grace to those that abandoned the covenant. Rome, of course, the two Egyptian kings had appealed to Rome for Rome's response by sending their navy. We understand that their naval commander met Anticus IV at Alexandria, and he was told to get out of Egypt and to leave the nation, so he's given a mandate. The order was a decree of the Roman Senate, and that if Anticus did not obey, he would be attacked by Rome. Then the commander drew, now listen to this, I think this is interesting. The commander of the Roman naval told him to, then the commander drew a circle on the ground around the feet of Anticus and demanded that he not step out of the circle till he gave him an answer or stated his intentions. And of course, with that mandate, we see that Anticus IV decided to leave Egypt. We understand that he would have left and headed home through Israel. And of course, because of his fury and his anger, we see he goes through Jerusalem, and there's where he begins to show forth his anger. He begins to carry out his actions, and he plundered the city. He killed thousands. He brought more into slavery. We see that with what power and control, or at that moment that he could over the Jewish people, he outlawed Judaism. He gave emphasis to Greek God worship. Of course, this was definitely working with breaking the covenant and the law, outlawing circumcision, where the Torah could not be read. And then, of course, real slap in the face, no Sabbath worship, no observance of the Sabbath. And so here's where we can see the significance of the possibility of even where the devastation of the mark of the beast will be a life and death scenario, because actually Anticus IV was willing to spare and not kill those that would totally abandon their Jewish faith. So there's a similarity to think of. we return to the scriptures of the 31st verse, let's see that the actions that Antiochus the Fourth has made in reference to the rage that he makes when he goes through Jerusalem on the way back to Syria doesn't stop with the actions that we mentioned just a few moments ago. We find in verse 31, and forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. Then they shall take away the daily sacrifice and place there an abomination of desolation. So here again, we're going to see the significance of the comparison of the aggression of Antiochus the Fourth and his characteristics and similarities of that of the Antichrist. The angel in this particular verse is giving us the understanding that he would desecrate the temple. Not only has he ravished or went in and looted and previous, but now he's going to desecrate the temple. Not only has he stopped Sabbath worship, the reading of the scriptures, now he's going to abolish a daily sacrifice. And if you remember correctly, in Judaism, they would have a morning oblation and they'd have an evening oblation. And with that being done, he would set up an abomination that would make the temple obsolete or desolate. Excuse me. We understand to enforce this, he would have sent troops to guard the temple. We understand that there would have been Jewish believers. There would have been those that would have came, or the Sabbath came, and there still would have been thousands that gathered. And with that had ignored Antiochus the Fourth, this was a way for him to count them as enemies. And with the fact that he had troops that were there standing guard at the temple, he considered these Jews enemies, and he slaughtered them, had them killed. And then we see where that Antiochus the Fourth does the abomination. He will actually sacrifice a pig or pigs on the altar to his heathen gods. And so we see the devastation, we see the demonic, we see the anti-God, we see him really shaking his fist in the face of Almighty God. Now, it's stated that he was insane. It may seem that he was full of the devils, what he was, and often referred to himself as a Greek god. Now, that right there is stating that he is exalting himself as God and even possibly considered himself to be Zeus. This was a type of the Antichrist who will sit in the temple that calls himself God. Now, he actually, again, let's emphasize the outlawing of the Jewish worship, and he replaced it with Greek worship, prefigures the Antichrist, bringing an end to sacrifice and offerings at the temple with demand that the people worship him in Daniel 9:27 and Revelation 13:15. So be reminded, those that would not adhere to Antiochus the Fourth, they were put to death. They were put to death. So it's also believed that the image that's mentioned here, that Antiochus Epiphanes the Fourth would have placed an image of Zeus in the holy place at the temple. Actually, we know that Jesus in Matthew 24, verses 16 and 17 tells us that the Antichrist will do this to the Jews. And we know that there will be many that will flee, and they will flee to the mountains. And of course, again, this is another indication and reference that they will go to an area that the Antichrist will not have control over, and that will be Petra. That will be in the area of Jordan. And so this is part of Bible prophecy yet to be fulfilled. Before we find a place to possibly pause and close this part three of class seven, on page 305, let's look at what is being said here by Ed Henson. It says, part of the deception perpetrated by the false prophet will be his power to give life to the image of the beast. Revelation 13:15. The biblical text, now I thought this was very, very interesting. The biblical text uses the word icon. We get our word icon for image. It means a representation derived from a prototype or a perfect likeness. It looks like the real thing, but it isn't. While we cannot be certain what image of the beast refers to, more and more scholars are suggesting the possibility of a televised holographic image or a computer icon. Now, I'm going to go even with this a little further that we have mentioned. I believe it will look so real that this is where we're going to see AI, the artificial intelligence, to bring it to life. With that thought, let's close with this thought. Just in the last week, I have seen where that Elon Musk is being supportive and they're working with AI in a way. And this is not new, but it's progressing and getting more knowledgeable to the public that where there will be, and they're working on it now, where chip can be placed in a person's brain that you pretty much will just think and it will operate your telephone or your electronic and do what you ask it to do without the touch of a screen or an icon or whatever. So I just wanted to emphasize that and place that, because these things may have looked as a general natural event taking place with what Antiochus the Fourth was doing in the temple, but the advancement of it is going to be even much greater because of the technology and people seeing it from all the way around the world at the same time and not be present, and it's going to be real. So keep that in mind as we continue to do our studies, these things that we have discussed. Now, I'm going to close at this time, and when we come back, we will pick up with a fourth part of the seventh class. I appreciate everybody's attendance. I appreciate everybody's participation to listen. I know that this 11th chapter has been very lengthy, and that's the reason we have attempted to give it as much as we can in shorter, and I know we've went over an hour this setting. So very soon we will be coming back and we will do class 7 part 4, and we will pick back up on page 306 and we will attempt to finish the 11th chapter in our next setting, Lord willing. Until then, God bless you.